This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are indeed people around us that we can call heroes because we don't really realize the lengths that they've gone to protect and preserve our freedom. Each week on this program, we visit with veterans of World War II. Our intent is to honor them for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget that price has been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories. And what a story today. A lot of this story you can find in book form. It's a really unique and captivating book, very well written, by a 94-year-old World War II veteran named Jerry Countess, lives in Las Vegas, Nevada. The book is called Letters from the Battlefield in Love and War. I have it linked on our website at hometownheroesradio.com. And Jerry's going to tell us some of that story today. First of all, I got to ask you, Jerry, 94 years old, you got a full head of hair, you still drive, you look like you have a lot more energy than I do. What's your secret?
Well, I don't know about having more energy. I have some, but it looks better than it is. I suddenly find myself walking now slower than I used to, and I walk past the store, and I see this big store window, and I look in the window, and there's an old man walking down there, and I finally read, that's me. that's very scary.
Jerry's had a very colorful life. He's been in Las Vegas the last 40 years, very active in the Jewish community here. And if you visit his office, you'll see pictures with him of with former Israeli heads of state, people like Shimon Peres and other faces that you might recognize. But long before that, you were just a young boy growing up in the Big Apple, raised by a single mother. What was your life like growing up there?
You have to remember, we were growing up, coming to life towards the end of the Depression. The worst part of it had been over, but everybody we knew had to work. Nobody was really trained in modern things like today. Most of the people that I knew, I lived in a part of Brooklyn called East New York, most of the people I knew there were men and women who came from Poland and Russia primarily, some from one or two other countries, with no training, and most went to work in the garment district in Midtown Manhattan. My mother lived in Brooklyn and had to take two trains every day to get to where she worked in Manhattan. Later on, many years later, she got to work in a factory in Brooklyn, so it was only one train or something. And there was no such thing at that time as an 8-hour day. It was more like a 10-hour day in most cases. But I was fortunate, she was fortunate, she lived with her mother. Her mother knew 10 words in English. She was a good cook, a great housekeeper, and she took care of our small three-room apartment. My mother went to work. She went out 6:37 in the morning, didn't come back till 6:37 at night. I almost never saw her. I saw her long enough for her to give me the facts of life as she knew them. You know, how to behave and how what to do. That was a different kind of behavior than you hear about today. But it was true for everybody. We learned a somewhat different world than there exists today. I went to see my mother in a factory. My mother was what was called a looper. I don't know if you know what looper. You're wearing a shirt. Mm-hmm. That collar on your shirt does not come with the body of the shirt. That collar is sewn on in the factory. It's sewn on by a woman who sits at a wheel about 2 feet in diameter with a certain amount of needles per square inch. So typically they said this was an 18-knit machine, a 16, a 20. That was how many needles there were to an inch. Mm-hmm. And she sat there all day, and that bloody machine was going around, and she'd pick up the shirt, put it on, and while it was going around, she'd pick up the collar, and when it came around again at the right place, she put it on and fed all them on as the wheel was turning. It never stopped. She turned it on. Then if there were sleeves and you had the cuffs on them, the same thing had to happen. So she did that. And she did that all bloody day long. Mm. 5 days a week. Early on, it was 6 days a week. The ILGWU at that time was a much beloved organization by the people who worked because they were doing 6 days a week. The people who were the owners of these places weren't worried too much about how you felt or what you did at any rate. So she did this all day long, every day. By the time she came home at night, she was out of energy, out of everything. My grandmother had made the meal. She made the meal. Within an hour, my mother was in bed.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have, I didn't have a lot of interchange with her, but enough for her to keep me on what in those days was considered the straight line. And all the guys and girls that I grew up with were like that. Mm-hmm. We learned a certain kind of civil life that's a little different than what it is today.
So growing up there, spending a lot of time with your grandmother and your mother and raised, as you say, with that view of the world and that kind of discipline and morals that they're trying to instill in you, I'm sure you had a lot of dreams of what you might do. I can see the energy you have today, and I can only imagine as a teenager, your head was probably full of some grand ideas. What were the things that you had ambitions for?
I don't think I had any ambitions until I graduated with a 79 3/4 average. That was 1/4 of a point less than I wanted to go to a particular high school where all my friends went. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't get in because I was 1 point short, so I had to go to a different high school. I went to Boys High. Boys High was well known because it was supposed to have a better level of education. To me, as long as I got through the class and didn't fail, that was okay. Some of the guys were pretty smart. I had no interest in that. But purely by accident, when I was about 13, 14, I stumbled into the Brooklyn Public Library. Can't tell you how that changed my life.
Mm.
I went into the library. Of course, it was free. I looked at this huge amphitheater inside. Seemed like huge to me. Nobody was there to tell you what to do. There were people there, but they didn't tell you what to do. So I went to the first bookcase set that I saw, and I looked at it, and a lot of books. And I looked around until I finally found one where there seemed to be books that I might be interested in. I got very interested in it. For a period of 2 years, I read a book every day.
Wow.
I took that book home. I sat down and I started to read it. I went to sleep at night when I finished it. In the morning, I went to school. From school, I went to the public library. And the public library was about a mile from my house. And I walked back. I did not know that I was reading what today we call the latest classics. I read Edgar Rice Burroughs, everybody you can name, the old guys, especially some of the guys whose stories, H.G. Wells and a couple of others like those, created sci-fi.
Uh-huh.
Everybody you can think of, every big writer. In those days, when you opened the book, there was usually a lithograph or something on one page in the front.
Right.
And it showed you something about what the story was about, or showed you a picture of a girl or a guy or something. That's how I picked the books. If they had a picture and I looked at it. As it turned out, I found out subsequently, many years later, that I had read probably 3/4 of all the famous literary classics that we see today or we know of today.
Mm-hmm.
We learned different morals, different background from these writers because most of the stories were 50 years, 100 years, 200 years old.
Yeah.
So we were reading, picking up what they did. I didn't know that I was learning style of writing. And I didn't know that I was reading the classics, but I found this one bookcase which was 8-10 feet long and 6 feet high, and that's what it had. So every day I went to school and I picked this book and went home with it.
Opened up a whole new world for you.
It opened a new world. I had no clue, nor did any of my friends have any clue about the world I was reading about. That changed me. All my friends went to either Brooklyn College or City College. And I couldn't get in because I had 1/4 of a point short. However, I could go to Knight College, $3 a point. If I took one class of 3 points, it cost me $9.
Tough.
That much money I was able to save. When I did that, I stumbled into something that every kid should stumble in. I stumbled into a teacher who was absolutely crazy about the subject he taught. He taught Greek and Roman civilization. This guy really was into that. And he made every one of us in that class get interested in that sub. Who would have thought about that?
Mm-hmm.
We lived in East New York. We didn't know about that. I fell for it when I was inducted into the Army. I took a book with me this big, the Oxford Book of English Verse. I was crazy about it. I knew 50, 60 poems already by heart. I took that with me into the Army. I never opened it once in basic training. And then when I went overseas, we had a barracks bag. And I took this 10-pound monster in my barracks bag. And later on, by accident, we stumbled upon our barracks bags and were allowed to go over to them, take out whatever we needed, and that was all we could take. And I realized at that time that if they saw that I had that book, my life wouldn't be worth anything. Can you imagine what they would say to me in combat? The Oxford Book of English verse?
Priorities.
So I stood with my back to the other guys, and I looked at that book, and I put it down to the bottom and covered with all the other stuff. Never saw it again. I have a couple of volumes of it here, but I never saw it again. But that book and this teacher changed my perspective, not on writing particularly, but suddenly I found that I was beginning to talk a little bit like that, and I wanted to. And I think that's ultimately why I became interested in writing. And I decided, you know what I want to do when I want to get out of the Army? I want to be a writer. A
few things that I'm curious about. First of all, I know that your Jewish heritage is such a big part of your identity. You know, if we look back now, and one of the things that we realize is what was happening in Europe was the extinction of the Jewish people at the hands of Adolf Hitler.
Yes.
Do you remember the first time you became aware of what was going on over there?
I became aware here in the United States before I went overseas, before I joined the Army. I can't say that I was on fire to attack it or not. I figured the Army would take care of that.
But this started to spread within your circle in New York, or you read the newspapers?
I read the newspapers. I can't say. All of the people I knew, most of them were Jewish, felt that way, but they never really talked much about it. We talked between ourselves on occasion, but never did. I never thought, first of all, I never thought if I went in the Army, I would be in the fighting part of the Army. But I never thought of being somebody who wanted to go out and fight that. But I thought that that was something we needed to do. And I thought that the Army, the gross Army, would some part of it would do that, as they subsequently did.
And you had a hand in that. And we're going to hear about some of that. Another question I like to ask every veteran, because everyone seems to remember something. December 7th, 1941. When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, where were you and how'd you find out that news?
I was in Brooklyn somewhere, I don't know. The only thing that all of us knew immediately was that the selection of people to go in the Army would suddenly mean something. And suddenly it made a difference. You knew that if you had a low number, you were going to be out there early. The guys I knew were pretty smart. They became accountants, bookkeepers, lawyers. None of them were in the fighting group of soldiers. Mm-hmm. I was the only guy in that group that did.
Well, and you tried to take matters into your own hands. You wanted to be in the Army Air Corps. You even tried the Navy. And tell me why they wouldn't take you.
They wouldn't take me because I was, unfortunately, partially colorblind. Just before we got in the Army, a friend of mine learned that the Coast Guard was interested and they needed people badly. We didn't know how dangerous it was to be in the Coast Guard. Even though all you did is you got on a ship, there were usually eight or nine or ten people who made up a little group, a little squad, and their job was to take care of the two-way radio. So he and I went to the Coast Guard and they said, oh, we need you. Come on and join us. So we came down and we looked down, filled out, and said, okay, fill it out. You have to take a test and you're ready to go. So first they gave us a physical test. They took everything. They said you're a wonderful guy, but you have to take the test before you go. We were so confident we were going to be taken in. We filled up our travel bag and we went on the subway to downtown Battery Park. We kissed our parents goodbye and we went down there and we passed everything. And then the guy said, well, before you go, you have to take the color test. So they gave us what was called the Ishihara eye test. It's a color test. And they show you a book with 16 pages. Each page has a different picture on the front made up simply of colored dots. And if you weren't colorblind, you'd look at it and see immediately, this dot's 13. I watched the other guys doing it. They didn't seem to have any problem. So I sat down at the table and he opened up the book and I saw a bunch of colored dots. He said, what number do you see? I didn't see any number. So of the 13 or 14 things that he showed, I saw five. When we finished with that, he looked at his captain or chairman or whatever and said, they shook their heads. They said, no. And I said, why? He said, look, if you're on a boat in the Atlantic Ocean, 1,000 miles from shore, and something happens to that radio, if you're going to put a red wire where a blue wire or a green wire is supposed to be, you're going to blow up the ship, you're going to blow up the boat, you're certainly going to blow up the radio. They couldn't take a chance. The Air Corps said the same thing. They said, look, one of the things you will be doing as a pilot is to be strafing the enemy lines. If you can't tell green from brown, you might be strafing our lines instead of the enemy line. We can't take a chance on that. Mm-hmm. Everybody had a good reason.
But you did end up in the Army in the Quartermaster Corps
for a while. And I was very happy with the Quartermaster Corps.
Because you thought, okay, if I'm in the Quartermaster Corps, I'm not going to be on the front lines.
Well, I thought that, and I thought I was going to be doing something useful. They put me in a huge boiler, about 20 feet long and about 6 feet high. And the whole purpose of it was to provide water so that when soldiers came off the battlefield temporarily, they could throw their clothing in there, have it sterilized and washed, and pick up another pair of stuff, new stuff that had been already washed and that was clean.
This is the bath and sterilization department.
Sterilization and bath, that was the name.
Uh-huh.
It made a lot of sense. Also, they had a thing with 8 showers alongside so soldiers could get a hot shower.
But if anyone reads your book, Letters from the Battlefield in Love and War, they're going to see that you say it was love that cost you that spot in the Quartermaster Corps. It was love that did a lot of things. And the love was directed at someone in this book that's referred to as RJG.
Joyce Gannis, yes.
Uh-huh. When did you first meet?
We met in 1938, I think.
And you developed some pretty strong feelings for her.
Very quickly we did, but she was going to be a nurse. She knew that when she was 12. At the age of 12, she told her parents, don't teach me how to cook, don't teach me how to sew, don't teach me how to wash. This is what I'm going to be. Her parents didn't like that. They had a large family, 6 other kids. All the kids did those things. She didn't. Mm-hmm. And when I met her, she was already working for a pittance, saving up enough money so she could go to nursing school. We were close together for a year or two. She went to Brooklyn College at night, as I did. I lived on this side of town. She lived over here. I drove my bicycle across town to her. We walked from there to back to her house, which was another mile or two. And we stayed out together until 12, 1 o'clock at night. And then I had a ride back by bike all the way across Brooklyn to the other side. But I didn't care. I was happy. I was also young.
Yeah.
My thighs were like that. Solid iron. At any rate, we did that. And then when I got in the Army, she got word that she was accepted for the Barnett Memorial Hospital in New Jersey, Paterson, mm-hmm. New Jersey. When I heard that she had gotten into that school and I knew I was going overseas, I knew that if I didn't do something quick about seeing her, we weren't going to see each other, possibly never. So me and 2 other guys who were in the regular Army went AWOL on a Saturday morning. We got a train, which was a 6-hour ride to New York. But we got a train. We went to New York. These 2 guys went out and had a great time for a weekend. I saw her. She said, oh, I had to go to the school where she was in Paterson, New Jersey. I went there. I found her. Everybody looked at me in an Army uniform. What the hell are you doing there? But I found her, and I proposed to her, and I said, okay, let's get married. We have a weekend. And she said, no. I don't want to be a widow before I'm a wife. She said, for me, marriage is something serious. I'm not going to do this for a one-night stand.
Mm-hmm.
I understood. I wasn't happy, but I understood what she said. I said, okay. And we kissed, and I got back into Manhattan. I got on the train at Penn Station, and I went back down to where it was. The train went down about 3 hours, no problem. And then suddenly the train stopped, was moved over onto a siding. Nobody knew why. We sat for over 2 hours. Until another train coming up from the south had to go past us, and they had to have the open road to go. Mm-hmm. So they went past us, and then we got back on. The train went back on the road. But I arrived back at Fort Lee, which is where I was at, 2 hours after Reveille in the morning.
Uh-oh.
That is precisely what. So I thought, well, you know, they won't let me take a weekend off, which is what one of the forms of punishment that they gave you. Well, you know, if you're sitting in an Army barracks and you couldn't go away for the weekend, it was no fun. So me and the other 2 guys went in. The 2 Army guys got 30 days. They couldn't leave the barracks. I got 30 days in jail.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know what jail was, but it was just a small building. It wasn't a regular big jail, and you couldn't get out of the building. However, they gave you a job. You couldn't just sit in the jail. My job was to go out with the cleanup detail every morning. The truck went around the area and picked up the full barrels of waste from every one of the barracks.
The
honey
buckets.
And they threw them into the truck.
Yeah.
Well, I thought it was going to be terrible, but it turned out not to be quite so terrible because all of the dirty stuff was taken somewhere else. So all they had was mail. I went through the mail, and I was sitting in the back of the truck. I dumped that out on the ground, on the back of the truck, and I take up a letter and look at it, and almost all the letters were from females, all the letters to males, and some were pretty juicy. So I read them, and I would tell you, hey, listen to this one. You got to read this one. Three guys would come up and sit down in the truck while we were riding, and I would read some of that stuff. It became a lot of fun.
And here I'm thinking, okay, you went to go ask the woman you love to marry you. She said no. It cost you your spot in the quartermaster corps. It's going to end up putting you in the infantry on the front lines. But you're having fun while you're in jail.
So far, yeah.
All right.
Except after 2 weeks, suddenly I got pulled out of jail, put back in my barracks, and 3 days later they told me, goodbye, you're going in the army overseas. When we got on the boat, we were given guns. In basic training, we had been given 1908 Springfields.
Mm-hmm.
We did get to shoot 12 shots. That was the training with a gun.
That was the extent of your training, and now you're heading overseas with an infantry division.
When I got overseas, I didn't get a Springfield. We got the brand new M1s.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody told us anything about the guns. Just, here's your gun.
And his overseas experience would be quite interesting and quite hairy. Go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos of today's guest, Jerry Countess. And we'll be back with more of his story right after this.
You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with an amazingly energetic 94-year-old from Las Vegas, Nevada, originally from Brooklyn, New York. Let's pick up where we left off with Jerry Countess, a World War II veteran from the 1st Infantry Division.
When you ship out, you're still a young man. You probably didn't really even know where you were going.
Nope, I did not know where I was going.
You hadn't had really any training for combat.
Correct.
But you know you're going to war somewhere. What is going through your mind? What do you think your expectation was?
I don't know that I had any serious expectations. We all knew we were going to war. We didn't know quite where. Halfway along the way, somebody spread the word that we were going to North Africa. I didn't even know there's a war going on in North Africa. At that time, the landing in North Africa took place only a month before we were going.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the world didn't even know that 80,000 American troops and a couple hundred boats landed on the shores of North Africa and conquered that. That was in the hands of the Germans. The French and the Italians had been in charge of that area. The Italians gave it, under Mussolini, became part of the German army. The French, yeah, what am I going to tell you about them? They didn't like the Germans any more than the Italians because the Germans abused them. They really were unkind to these guys. These guys could have been very helpful to them, but they antagonized them so much that these guys really were not unhappy when the United States troops landed. So they fought, but not with full ardor, you know.
Well, and you've got a story in your book about that, about you coming across a couple Italian soldiers who you took prisoner, but they were pretty happy to see you.
They were very happy to see me.
Before we get to that, so you are put into the 1st Infantry Division, and folks probably have heard about the Big Red One, and they probably associate...
I had never heard of it in my life.
You hadn't, but I'm saying now people, all these years later, if they hear about the Big Red One, they probably think, okay, Omaha Beach, D-Day. That would be one of the famous spots. Maybe they don't realize that so many of you were in North Africa fighting the Germans down there. And what was your baptism by fire, if you will, your introduction to combat?
I had never fired a gun at anybody. I didn't know anything. Nobody really wanted to tell me and the two or three other recruits about what was going on because they didn't expect us to survive much. So the first, we were maybe 4 or 5 days in the outfit trying to find out something, and all of a sudden some guy comes along, tonight you're going to combat. What does that mean? I don't know. Get dressed, put on your overcoat, because it was pretty damn cold in North Africa. People didn't think so. And we're going to take you in your fire. We want you to see if he can capture a couple of guys for interrogation, but you also got to fight these guys. Everybody said, okay, we're going to go. What are you going to do? So I got into a 2.5-ton truck with all the other guys. Pitch dark, didn't know where the hell we were going, and the trucks don't drive with lights on. So we didn't know where we were going. There was nobody in the truck with authority who could tell us where we were going. We got there, the truck stopped. What I didn't know at the moment that it stopped was that there was a whole line of trucks there, maybe 25 or 30 of them, I don't know, filled with soldiers. Truck stopped, the back panel of the truck went down. We all jumped out on the ground in our overcoats, in our helmets, with a rifle I had never used, I had never shot before. We stood, the trucks drove away. So we're standing there, you know, and along comes the sergeant major, comes running down the thing. Okay, we're going to attack in 5 minutes, fixed bayonets.
Yeah.
I said, what, are they broken? The guy next to me, standing next to me, just looked at me and had no use for me whatsoever. And I'm watching, and all of a sudden I see, you couldn't see more than 10 feet, 15 feet. But the guys I could saw. All had their rifles with the butt on the ground, and they had a bayonet on top of it. And I looked at that, and I said, where'd you get the bayonet? And they said a few words, which I won't talk about. And the guy came over to my backpack and pulled out a bayonet from my backpack. I didn't know it was in a sheath on my backpack.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He gave it to me. What do I do with it? It's not broken. How can I fix it? He had a few words to say. But he took that and he clamped it down on top of the gun. And if you push it down, it clicks and it's secure. Okay, where are we going? There.
Just pointed a finger into the darkness.
Pitch dark. Okay, I figure whatever they're going to do, I'm going to do. So we face this way, and instead of being behind each other, we're alongside of each other. We heard the word attack, and he says, run. You're wearing an overcoat that's down to your knees. And it I don't know how much it weighs, but it certainly had to weigh 10, 15 pounds. Hotter than hell, and you start running with the overcoat, with a gun. You're carrying a gun in your hands, and you don't know exactly where you're going or what you're doing or who you're going at. But that we couldn't see an enemy. Well, we start to charge. After 5 minutes, nobody was running. And we're walking, and where are we going? We don't know. Does anybody have a map? Nobody has a map. What are we going to do? Where are they? Who's we shooting? So we walked, and the other guys are beginning to feel as stupid as I did. And suddenly, out of a clear blue sky, we're up against a barricade. We thought it was a barricade. It was a mountain, almost vertical in front of us. Okay, so now what do we do? Sergeant said, climb it. Are you crazy? Well, as it turned out, I was with two or three or four other guys. We worked together as a team. Two guys held the rifles. One guy climbed up as far as he could climb, maybe 6, 8, 10 feet. We handed up the rifles, and we followed him up to the ledge. Then another guy would take the guns, and another guy would go up 6 feet, 5 feet, 8 feet, whatever amount of feet. But we were in overcoats. The third time around, most of those overcoats fell to the ground. At any rate, we kept doing that. We didn't hear any shots. We didn't hear firing anywhere, but we were attacking. And we didn't know who or what. When it became my turn, I went up, and I get on, I'm climb up a bit, and I get my hands on, and it's a ledge. Wow, a ledge. And I pull myself up a little bit, and when I get up about this high, there's a face on the ledge looking at me, and I'm looking at it, and he's smiling. And I notice that his helmet is not an American helmet. There's an expression I could use, but I won't. I don't have my gun. The gun's down there 10 feet below me. Here is this guy. I did recognize the fact that his hat was an Italian hat. But I know that they're the enemy. And he smiles, and he says, come on. He doesn't say. He gestures.
Gestures you with his hand to come here.
And I'm looking down. I don't have a gun, and this guy is laying there. And I don't know if there's other guys up there. I didn't know what to do. He leans over, grabs the back of my coat, and pulls. And I come up on the ledge. I figure, well, now he's going to shoot me or something. No. He looks down, and he says, you're the two. He goes like this, come on up. I leaned over and I told him, come on up as fast as you can and bring my rifle. They came up the way I went up, you know. They got onto the ledge. This guy was standing there and smiling and talking, kamerad, kamerad. And the only thing we knew in German was kamerad, which means I give up.
Uh-huh.
While we're doing that, a guy comes out. It turned out there was a little cave up there. A guy comes out, and he's dressed somewhat differently. Much nicer uniform, and he has a pistol. He doesn't have a rifle. And he comes over and smiles. He says, "Mi camarade, come." It took a little conversation and waving of the hands to realize that they wanted to give up. If he wanted to shoot, we would have been dead a long time ago. All they had to do was push us off that damn cliff and we would have been dead. They wanted to be taken as prisoners. Well, that was exactly what we were supposed to be doing. Okay, so what do we do? He said, he took us into the back, and there was a little stove on a tripod about a half a foot tall. Coffee he made. I don't know. He said it was coffee. And it was hot. That was all that counted. So the three of us dragged, and we didn't know what should we do with our rifles. They weren't concerned about that. They didn't care. He says, okay, we go down. I said, we're not going to be able to go down this ledge. Climbing up was easy, but going down, he said, no. And he pointed over there. Over there was about 10 yards away from us. There was a path going down the side of that mountain to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And we had climbed up the way we did. So we understood that we got to find some group of people from intelligence who would take him over and get what they wanted. The guy said, you go down with him. You are the one who got this? Fine. You have the right to go down. I went down, and the two of them, I followed them down. I was in the back, not in the front. They walked down, I walked down. We ultimately got to the ground, found some American soldiers, told them I was looking for intelligence. They told me to go here. I went here. They told me to go here. And the two guys followed me everywhere. It was like a trio. Finally, some people said, oh, intelligence is right over there. So I went with the two guys. I saluted the captain. And I told him how happy we were. He said, these are the first prisoners anybody ever captured. I said, wow, that's great. And as soon as I say that, the captain puts his hands inside his blouse and takes out a pistol. I thought our captain was going to crap in his pants. The guy is 5 feet away from him. He's got a pistol. The guy takes the gun, turns it around, and hands it to him. He looks at me. I said, they don't want to fight. They just want to be prisoners.
So they were upset with you for not having confiscated his
this
pistol.
This guy said a few things that fortunately the Italians didn't understand. And he said, the next time you have any kind of relief, I'm going to find you, and you're going to pay for this. And I want to tell you that that's what happened. Maybe 10 weeks later, I don't know, somewhere in that neighborhood, we were taken out for, they call it rest and rehabilitation. It's not. It's just recharging of the, if you have your stockings with the holes in them, they gave you stockings. If you had underwear, you got a piece of underwear. And we were doing that. We're sitting on the ground doing it, and this captain came down with two guys with him, and they took my backpack, and they filled it with stones, and I put it on, and I had to walk for 2 hours up and back along the shoreline. And his guy stayed there to make sure that I did it.
All his punishment for putting his life at risk by bringing in a prisoner who was still armed.
That's absolutely correct.
Uh-huh. And you told me one of the reasons that you wrote this book, and this book, Letters from the Battlefield in Love and War, it's comprised of letters that you wrote to Ray, who you talked about, who you were in love with, who said she wouldn't marry you before you went overseas, and also to another friend of yours, and their letters that were written to you as well. And it tells a lot of these stories, but you said one of the reasons you wrote it is you want people to know what it's really like out there. Not necessarily the guts and the glory and the combat, but the day after day of life that changes the way you see your existence.
Well, it was early on. Later on, I was able to write that because I knew, not exactly, but I had lived through the business of what it was like. The first thing you do when you stop walking, the absolute first thing you do, even if you're only going to stop for 2 or 3 hours, you dig a foxhole. Invariably, the Germans held a higher level, and you fought to take it. When you took it, then you went forward again. You're going down the mountain, you went up a one. They were higher. So they could see, not well, but they could see how many troops there were and what was going on. So if you stopped on a mountain ridge or you stopped in a low place, you were pretty sure that the Germans higher than you were watching you with glasses, telescopes. So you dug a foxhole. I was very lucky. I was short. I could dig a foxhole faster than the tall guys. We all carried the most important instrument, a shovel, about a foot and a half long, but it had a head about this big. The purpose of that shovel, as soon as you stopped, you reached behind you, uncorked it, and you started digging. If you were lucky, you were digging in sand. But in the mountains, you weren't digging in sand. So digging a foxhole was a very arduous thing.
But that could be the difference between life and death.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The purpose of a foxhole is to keep you below the level where shrapnel flying this way can't touch you. But if you were out of that foxhole, shrapnel flying at the height of a half a foot or whatever, you would be touched, seriously.
And I'm sure you saw some friends that happened to.
At one time, we did something we never did. It was so bloody cold up in the mountains that three of us got together and we decided we were going to dig one foxhole for the three of us because we would be warmer. And we each had a small blanket in theory that was supposed to be a tent half. So it kept us warm. We were once bombarded by the Germans and two of the guys with me, both of them were hit by shrapnel. Not terribly, enough to send them to the hospital.
In the same foxhole as you?
One very minor, the other one with a serious piece of shrapnel on his back.
You have here in your office a Purple Heart, a Silver Star, Bronze Star. Those all took place because of what you did over there. And the Purple Heart indicates that eventually you were wounded as well. Tell me the story about the Silver Star, because you actually wrote about it in a letter to your love back home in the States. And that letter is part of your book here, Letters from the Battlefield in Love and War.
In a real big war, I probably wouldn't have gotten a Silver Star for that. The reason I got a Silver Star was because of what I did, who I rescued. This was relatively early on. I was in the Army maybe a month or 2 months. We were supposed to be going to an area where we knew the Germans were. We were going to try to surround them and go around on each side of them. So my group went left. All of a sudden, out of a clear blue sky, I'm all there by myself. Where did everybody go? Where was left? I saw a trail, theoretically, not a real foot trail, but I saw steps then. And I was starting to go in that direction. To my right, there was a high sloping piece of ground. And then on top, there were strange looking things which I couldn't identify. I didn't know what they were. I started to make the left move and I heard a voice. And I looked in front of me where I heard the voice, maybe 50 yards in front of me, maybe that far. And the guy called and he said, "Hey, who is it?" And I said who I was. It was the first sergeant of my company. Now, that's the highest rank you can get outside of an officer. Tough guy, a regular Army guy. He knew what he was doing. He said, "Hey, who was it?" And I said, "Jerry." "Oh," he said, "okay, you got to get me out of here." What does that mean, get me out of here? How do you do that? "Well, there's a machine gun up there." They dug a hole, and they had a machine gun up there, maybe 200, 250 yards away, uphill. Mm-hmm. He said, "They have tried twice to get me." He said, "I have a rock here that I'm behind." He said, "The rock is only a foot and a half tall and maybe 2 feet wide." He says, "If they hit that rock often enough with their machine gun, that rock is going to go to pieces and I'm going to be dead." He said, "Get me out of here."
So how would Jerry pull that off? We'll find out when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with a veteran of the Big Red One, the 1st Infantry Division. He served in North Africa with the 26th Regiment, Company B. He's a recipient of the Silver Star, the Bronze Star, and the Purple Heart. He minimizes that injury as a few pieces of rock that struck him in the arm. He's a humble guy, but a great storyteller. And when we left off, Jerry Countess was telling us the story of how he earned the Silver Star, rescuing a sergeant who was outnumbered and hiding behind a tiny rock.
I looked up the hill, and I saw that black spot, and I realized now I knew what it was. It was the guy's machine gun, and I didn't know what I would do. While I was looking at that, a guy came up behind me, one of my people. He called me. He said, "What are you doing over here?" I said, "I'm not supposed to be here, but I was supposed to go around here, but the sergeant is up there, and he's stuck behind the rock." He said, "He ain't going to be there long." I said, "I know. What do I do? I have to get him out." He says, "If you get this guy out of there, he's going to be so visible to these guys that he may have to run 50 yards. He ain't never going to make it. Of course, they're going to shoot him." It made sense. I understood what he was saying. And an idea occurred to me. I have no particular reason why. I said, "Do you have ammunition?" He said, "Yeah, I got some." I said, "Do you have any armor-piercing ammunition?" Armor-piercing is different. It's special ammunition designed for that particular purpose. In theory, it was supposed to penetrate German tanks. It didn't always do that, but it was a lot tougher than the regular bullets. He said, "Yeah, I got a couple of things." I said, "Look, give me two of those rounds. Each piece of stuff that it was stuck into had six bullets in it. So he was going to give me 12. He said, what are you going to do with it? I said, I'm going to try to take down that machine gun nest up there. He said, you can't see anybody. You can't see them close enough to hit them. I said, I'm not worried about hitting them. What I want to do is hit the parapet, which was rocks. Mm-hmm. They had built it, you know, big rock, this big, but they built it around them. I said, if I can blow up those rocks, the pieces of rock with the shrapnel might get a guy or two, and they'd be so busy, this guy could run away. He said, his life is going to depend upon you doing it. I talked to the sergeant briefly. I said, look, I'm going to fire at them. I want to keep them occupied for a while. If you hear me shooting and you don't hear any bullets coming down at you, you can take off. It's the best I can do. He said, okay. What I did is instead of being where I was, I went further, a little further downhill because there was a big shrub I saw. Not a big shrub. A medium-sized shrub that I saw. Give me some protection for a while. They'd have to find out where I was shooting from. So I took off my hat and I went down maybe 20 yards. I don't know how far. And there was a shrub, and I got into the shrub, and I laid down behind it, and I took out my rifle, and I pushed it through the shrub. Just to test, I shot one or two shots. Not the armor-piercing, but I shot my regular gun. Went 50 yards to the left of where I was shooting. And I realized what I was doing is looking through my scope. I was looking. The back part was on my gun, but the left part wasn't on my gun, which is facing this way. It was on a bush. So I was shooting 25, 35 yards. Fortunately, they were a little busy up there. So I saw what it was, and I was able to move my gun. And now I had the gun. And I yelled to the first sergeant. I said, okay, we're going to go. And I started to shoot at them. The first shots that I had, they fired back where I was. Not exactly where I was, but they were firing. But what happened is the armor-piercing bullets really blew some of those stones apart. And apparently, it hit two people. I heard screams from one of them. I don't know what happened with the other one. But once I knew that I had hit him, then I used the second armor-piercing thing, you know, to do some more. While I was doing that, the first sergeant got out, came down a few feet, and turned off to the left and ran on behind, and he got out safe. I think that I really quieted that machine gun nest. You know, they weren't shooting anymore. I got my helmet, and I took off. I think I really got them bad enough so that was inoperative at that time.
Well, and you just said something. You said, I got my helmet, and I took off. That implies you didn't have your helmet while you were shooting at them.
No,
explain to us why you didn't have your helmet on.
Because I was behind a bush. The helmet is an unnatural thing. It's a shiny. It doesn't show sunlight reflection, but it's a solid piece of stuff this big in there around. So when they're looking at it, it's not nature. It's not part of nature. I could have put the hat 10 feet away on the ground. They would have known that. If they were smart, they would have seen it was on the ground. It wasn't on anybody's head. So
was that just instinct, or had you been taught that?
That was instinct. Nobody talked. You learn a lot of things by yourself when they're shooting at you.
What do you think would have happened to him if you weren't there and if you didn't do what you did?
He would have been turned into pulverized powder. With that machine gun from where they were, and there were two machine guns up there, I think, if he even moved, they were already reducing the size of the piece of stone he was behind. If they had done a little more of that, that would have blown to pieces. Either the pieces would have gotten him or they would have seen him. Now, he had to go maybe 25, 35 yards to get out and around the mountain. That would have given them enough time to really take him apart with the machine gun.
So there's no question you saved his life.
He didn't think there was any question about it, yeah.
But you risked your life to save his.
You risk your life every day when you're in a firing area. You know, whatever you do, you're doing. That was nothing special. If it was me, I would have wanted somebody guy come along to try to do something to save me. You know, mm-hmm. That was normal.
Well, and if people get your book, Letters from the Battlefield in Love and War, they'll realize you had some other close calls. One of them involves a cave and a Tommy gun and almost killing some guys who you were afraid were going to hunt you down and kill you.
That was part of learning, yeah.
Yeah, and okay. I hope people will get the book so they can read that story. But if I were to say, what was your closest call? Realizing that you're there in North Africa in 1943, then in Italy all the way past Germany's surrender in Europe. So you're over there a long time. I'm sure you had a lot of close calls. What was the moment where you felt you came closest to not coming home and trying to track down that special lady again?
something that happened when we were attacking the Germans in Sicily. I saved a good part of my company. It had been was not intentional. I didn't know I was going to be doing it. Sicily is a huge collection of mountains, one after another, every way you look. Half of my company went up to the top of a certain area. And my job at that time was, I wasn't a typical fighting soldier. I was like the runner. Mm-hmm. My job was, remember, we didn't have cell phones at that time. we had a phone that was carried on a thing like this, and it worked when you turned the handle. But the battery died quickly. Sometimes it died and you didn't even know it died. It didn't always work, and even when it worked, you weren't sure you were going to get battle headquarters. They went up there, and they were doing their job, you know, fighting the enemy, and all of a sudden, the Germans had new recruitment or whatever. They were really pounding on these people. Unexpectedly, these guys didn't expect to have that many people up there. They were in serious trouble. I had gone up to tell the captain something or whatever that from here, and that's what happened. Oh, my God, you could see stuff flying all over the place. He said, you got to go down and tell them. He said, otherwise, by half an hour from now, we're going to be dead. He said, go down. You're the runner. You know which way to go. You know where the group is. Go get them and tell them. So I ran down that mountain. I have to tell you, most of the time I wasn't running. I was flying. I jumped going down from one, maybe 20 feet, 15 feet down, landed, fell over, got up, and kept running. It was a nightmare.
With enemy fire coming in the whole time?
Coming in, but not specifically at me. It was coming all over the place.
Sure.
The real danger to that was I could have broken a leg or broken an ankle. That would have been put me into real problems.
Because then you wouldn't have been able to get out.
I wouldn't have been able to get out. And if they took over that, the captain and his crew up there, they were going to come down.
Yep.
And I'd have been up the creek without a paddle.
Yeah.
But, you know, lives of 10, 15, 20 guys are up there. So I had to go. I went down that mountain. I would never do that again in my life. But I was young. I was full of energy and strong and driven by the necessity. I was more frightened than if they were shooting at me specifically, just going down because I knew time was of the essence. Mm-hmm. I had to get down there as soon as I can, or if I got down a long time, they wouldn't be alive.
So you made it in time.
Made it in time. I got the guy, and they had a phone that was working, not well, but working. They notified the artillery,
mm-hmm.
and the artillery started shooting up at there, and the guys got out. Most of them got out. A few were hurt or wounded, one or two were killed, but basically most of them got out.
So you made it. You saved their lives in the process. You avoided your life being taken. And here's another thing. You getting hit and killed, obviously, is not the ending you're looking for, but your being captured could have been equivalent. I've heard a lot of stories from people who were captured by the Germans. If, depending on where you were, if the Germans found out about your Jewish heritage, could have been the end for you.
Yeah, it might have. Absolutely. I'll tell you a story about being captured. This was when I first joined, and I really didn't know very much. Remember, I told you that there were 8 different marching commands. This was maybe 3 or 4 weeks after I joined. We came to a place with a couple of mountains like this. So they gave us the command to march in a straight line, one behind the other. One platoon, 38, 36 guys, 3 or 4 squads. I was in the second squad, and we started to go up the hill. The Germans did something very clever. They stayed on both sides of where we were marching.
Mm.
When we went up, halfway up, they went in this way. What they did is made it impossible for the guys in the back to shoot them because our guys were in the front.
Mm-hmm.
The guys in the front couldn't shoot back. Of course, we were in the back. So these guys took the front group lock, stock, and barrel. They got them, and we couldn't shoot at them. They took them away. So we lost 15, 14, something number of guys like that.
So if you had been on that half of where the Germans came in?
I'd have been up the creek. At any rate, I just want to finish this story. A year and a half, 2 years later, the war ended. And I was in one of the first guys to be picked to go back home because of the number of different points I had irrelevant. So I got back and I got back on the boat, and there are a couple thousand guys on the boat, and we were very lucky. Instead of the terrible weather we had going back, this was July, the weather was beautiful, the ocean was flat, and so I got on the boat. There are a couple thousand guys in there. Nobody wanted to sleep below. It was impossible. But we stayed up on top of the boat all day. I got to the rail of the boat, and I see some people I know. We're talking, and I turn around, and I see about 15 feet behind me, there's another small group of guys talking. There's one guy standing there looking at me. We went down. We had lunch. I came back up again, and I go back to the same place, and there's the same guy there, and he's still looking at me, and he smiles. I don't know exactly what he was aiming at, but I didn't say anything. He came over to me. He said, "Hello, Jerry." He says, "You don't remember me?" "No, I don't remember you." He says, "I was in your platoon." "Not in your squad, but in your platoon." That is, platoons, 48, 50 people. So four squads, maybe 12 in each one. Mm-hmm. He was in the squad immediately before me on that hill. He was two guys ahead of me, and the line went, the Germans went between us.
Wow.
He was taken to Germany, and he worked in a German factory for almost the full 2 years making tanks.
Wow.
He says, "You can be sure that a lot of those tanks had deficiencies."
Uh-huh. He sabotaged
But them. That's where he was. So, yeah, he and a couple of other people obviously did that. But he spent the entire time that we went through all this crazy stuff, he was in a factory, getting up in the morning, working in the factory all day at night. And I asked him, I said, "Would you rather have been with us instead of in the factory?" He said, "No."
Uh-huh.
I understand. But what a coincidence, you know.
Yeah, and I guess that's a, hey, that could have been me moment.
If they'd have come up a little further, I was two guys away from him.
Mm-hmm. And you were helpless, unable to fire because
couldn't
you would
fire.
Have been hitting
couldn't
your own
fire.
People.
Right.
I know your story has so many twists and turns, and hopefully people listening are intrigued enough that they'll go online at hometownheroesradio.com and find the links to your book, Letters from the Battlefield in Love and War. But I think we can let them know how that story ended. If you have all these letters in this book and you found them somehow, what happened with that young lady you'd asked to marry?
She was working as a nurse in a hospital without any superiors, so they had to do a lot more work. They were working 12 hours a day, 14 hours a day in the hospital. They were the nurses. When she knew she was going home, I knew that I would be going home relatively shortly. I didn't know when. The war ended. I got there. She wasn't there. She had already gone home. They had released her. So I went back to Brooklyn, and I knew the building she lived in. I knew which train went there, because that's where I used to go to all the time.
Yeah.
I told her on the phone that I was coming, and when I got there, I got to the apartment house. I was very impressed by the apartment house. It was the only apartment building I'd ever seen that had an elevator in it. She lived on the ground floor. I never used it, but I was very impressed by the elevator. So I finally went down a long hall. I got to the door of her house. She had been smart enough to tell her mother and father to take a hike for a while. I got to the door. I couldn't wait. Knocked on the door, rang the bell, no answer. Knocked on the door, rang the bell, no answer. Knocked on the door, and suddenly I heard a voice on the other side. She said, "Yeah, it's me." I said, "Okay, open the door." "No." I said, "Open the door." "No." "Why?" "I can't. It's been too long. I can't. I got so furious. I said, "You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to break that door down. I'm going to back up and go charging at the door. And if I get killed trying to break through that door..." I heard a click. The door was open, unlocked. And I went in. Out of a clear blue sky, one of her relatives, her older sister, had a husband who was unexpectedly rich, and he decided that he was going to make the marriage for us. And they did it in the basement of his house. They invited about 100 people, all relatives. I had no relatives. I have no sisters, no brothers, no aunts, no uncles, no cousins, nothing. It was just my mother, my grandmother, and me.
Mm-hmm. But all that time that you're overseas, all the times your life could have ended, and again, she'd already said no to you once, but it works out that you come back, you find her again, you marry, you have children and grandchildren, and all these years together. That's pretty amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I think I'm one of the luckiest guys alive.
And I don't think anyone who's listened for the last hour is going to disagree with that. Thank you, Jerry, for serving our country. Thank you for telling us your story. Thank you for giving us something to shoot for when we're 94, Lord willing. Go to hometownheroesradio.com for more info on Jerry's book. And join us again next time as we're reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.